ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Dinosaurs. That has been my thing for a very, very long time, and I was very happy to hear there's a new dinosaur movie at the cinemas out now. The premise is, what would happen if dinosaurs turned up in sleepy suburbia? And that's what it's about. It's called End of Oak Street, and it stars Anne Hathaway and Ewan McGregor. I haven't seen it yet because the aforementioned two little kids have sort of prevented that, but I will try soon. But it does feel kind of strange talking about a dinosaur film that doesn't start with the word Jurassic. And I have to say, as a dinosaur fan, the films have kind of let me down lately. But since Steven Spielberg blew audiences away in the 90s, starring, of course, the beloved Sam Neill, the franchise has had exclusive rights to prehistoric beasts, it seems, even if some of the follow-ups have been, not so great. But the Jurassic Park films are not the only dinosaur films out there. We'll hear from one of our resident film and TV critics, Sarah Ward, in just a moment. We're going to look at the evolution of dinosaur films. And if you have any that you want to give a shout out to, that number, 1-300-800-222, or you can text 0467-922-702, or you can tell me how many times you've seen Jurassic Park if you want. But let's say hello to Sarah now. Sarah, welcome to Nightlife.
Hello.
Now, you're a film critic for Screen International, so you know your stuff on all sorts of films, but dinosaur films, is that a special interest?
Well, look, I am a fan of dinosaur films, but I think we all are. I mean, we have a huge box office haul for the 7 Jurassic Park and Jurassic World franchise movies so far. I think they've made almost $7 billion across the last 3 decades.
Wow.
But I think we're all a fan of dinosaur movies because we're all a fan of dinosaurs, even if we think we've grown out of it as a kid. I don't think that's the case. You go to a museum, you see people standing around when, particularly if there's a fossil, a big skeleton, like a T-Rex somewhere, adults are looking at that with their jaws agape just as much as children are. I think, as I said, we all love dinosaurs. We all love dinosaur movies.
Yeah, let's have another little jog of the memories from that first Jurassic Park film. This is when Dr. Grant, Sam Neill, is getting his first look at the dinosaurs.
How fast are they?
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles an hour.
T-Rex?
Mm-hmm.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh.
Say again.
We have a T-Rex.
Wow.
Put your hand between your knees.
Dr. Grant, my dear Dr. Sattler, welcome to Jurassic Park.
So, like you said, there's been another 6 Jurassic Park films, but none have really lived up to the brilliance of the original, have they? What do you think?
Well, I think that's exactly spot on. And interestingly enough, this is a film, the original, based on a 1990 novel by Michael Crichton. And I was doing some reading about him in preparation for this chat. And he's also somebody that said that, when he first started writing the book, he kind of put it aside because he thought there were too many dinosaurs. There was too much kind of dinosaur mania at the time. And he thought it would go away, that it was a fad. And then he realized that no, everybody likes dinosaurs all the time. And he thought first, okay, maybe it's just kids that like it. And then he observed that his daughter was liking dinosaurs before other kids could be telling her about them, and realized, just as I just said, that you go to a museum, adults are in there too. So you've got this book then written by somebody who really gets the fact that we all love dinosaurs. And then you get a filmmaker like Steven Spielberg who comes along, who apparently he learned of the book while he was talking with Crichton about what would eventually become a different kind of huge 90s era hit, the medical TV series ER, which Crichton created and Spielberg's production company was behind. And Spielberg himself had always wanted to make a dinosaur movie because he was a huge fan of Ray Harryhausen. And, you know, there, kind of from there, the rest is history.
We've got a text from John Boy who wants to give a big shout out for the original and the best dinosaur, Godzilla. And he says that Mothra comes in as second best. Thanks, John Boy. Look, it's not all going to be about Jurassic Park films, this discussion, but you can't not mention it. And I have to say, Sarah, that my heart was absolutely broken by Jurassic World Dominion. I kept saying to myself, it's going to get good. It's going to get good. Oh, please, when is it going to get good? And then when the final big baddie was not a dinosaur, in fact, it was a swarm of giant prehistoric locusts, I thought, well, that's the whole point. We're watching this for the dinosaurs. Where are they? So is Dominion the worst? What went wrong there, do you think?
Look, I think it's not great at all. It's a movie that in the lead up, there was so much hype about the fact that they had, you know, the franchise's Holy Trinity back. They had Sam Neill, Laura Dern, Jeff Goldblum all back, all in the same movie. That's worth being excited about. But then around that, for me, that movie borrows so liberally from so many other movies beyond the Jurassic World, Jurassic Park franchise. You've got elements of Star Wars and Bond and Bourne and Taken and Indiana Jones and Alien and The Birds and Austin Powers, even Fast and Furious. I can remember watching it kind of ticking off going, yep, that scene also done in this movie, that scene also done in this other movie. It just felt so generic. You kind of rampantly splicing together disparate parts and then reanimating the past, perhaps really fitting given what the films are about, but it really didn't work as much as you wanted it to, because again, Sam Neill, Laura Dern, Jeff Goldblum, all in it together. But I also think Fallen Kingdom, the film before that, was not great either. It gets really and silly.
Mm. And the Fallen Kingdom and Dominion, especially Dominion, feel like a bit of a box-ticking exercise, like you say. How many of these cliches can we hit to be as broadly appealing as possible? And ironically, it ends up not being appealing. But I have to say, the first rebirth of the franchise starring Chris Pratt, which I believe was, they all blend into one, don't they? But what I do remember about that one was I really was scared of the big baddie in that one, the Indominus Rex, the T-Rex Raptor hybrid. That I don't want to spoil how that dinosaur story eventually ends, but it's pretty spectacular with another large dinosaur. But I do remember liking that one and holding out hope, but then, yeah, like you say, was disappointed by Fallen Kingdom. But now we've got The End of Oak Street, which this is out now, and it's been described as the best dinosaur movie since Jurassic, the original Jurassic Park. I'll just play a bit of the trailer for us.
Water's not working.
Looks like the whole neighborhood's lost power.
I don't want you to tell me it's time to come home.
We can't leave.
I think that our neighborhood, our house, our whole street has moved.
Now the hell is that even possible?
Get out of there, run!
That was the trailer for The End of Oak Street film, which is out now. You're listening to Nightlife. We're speaking with Sarah Ward, who is a film and TV critic for Screen International. Sarah, what do you think? What's your take on End of Oak Street as a dinosaur film? That's what we're talking about tonight. What's your review?
Well, it does stand out in that it does feel rare to get a dinosaur movie in cinemas that doesn't have the word Jurassic in the title. But it's also one where you watch it and you kind of go, I can't believe no one, including the Jurassic Park franchise, did this before, in that it is really a backyard set version of Jurassic Park.
Well, they tried. I'll jump in there. This is where my fixation is going to come through, Sarah. I apologize. I'm correcting things. Well, they tried. They hinted at it with various scenes. They were in the sequel Lost World, when the T-Rex lands in San Francisco off the back of a boat. There were hints of dinosaurs in backyards and that sort of thing. But actually, as a setting, no, you're correct. Yeah, it wasn't ever done.
Because what you get here is, you know, an ordinary American family in 1982 suddenly find that their entire neighborhood has been sent back in time, ripped from its present patch of earth and planted back millions of years ago. And so, of course, that does mean you've got dinosaurs. You've got houses and backyards and roads and cars and pets and people, you know, Anne Hathaway, Ewan McGregor among them. And then you have dinosaurs and these other prehistoric animals roving around these suburban and domestic spaces and doing what they do, which is hunting for their next meal. And it is gripping because there are dinosaur films that have tried to play with this idea in a way before, but this feels as though you are plunged right in it, you know, following these characters do what people do in a lot of dinosaur movies, try and survive this interaction with these prehistoric beasts around all of these incredibly recognizable everyday, you know, spaces. It's also a film that does two things. It really appreciates the awe and the wonder and the terror that we have for dinosaurs. It isn't afraid to recognize that there's something pretty ridiculous about even contemplating humans and dinosaurs being in the same space, because it'd never work out well for humans as well. So it's a film that can be quite tense and has some, you know, great dinosaur attack moments, but also has a sense of humor and knows exactly what it's doing. It's a really nice balancing act from the filmmaker behind this, David Robert Mitchell. But it is also a movie that, you know, more than once tonight, the name Steven Spielberg is going to come up, because this is a film that, you know, does take cues not only from the Jurassic Park movies, but elsewhere across Steven Spielberg's filmography, because he was a director who, as I said, really wanted to make a dinosaur movie. And you can kind of see elements across his filmography, making a creature feature to begin with Jaws. He makes a film, a whole trilogy of films about an archaeologist with the Indiana Jones movies. You know, he gets humans interacting with creatures that we can't really interact with normally. Aliens in Close Encounters of the Third Kind and E.T. feels like his path was leading to Jurassic Park. And here with the end of Oak Street, you also have a filmmaker that's taking, you know, kind of owing a debt to a lot of movies along that path. Also working with a producer in J.J. Abrams, who also has films that owe a debt to Spielberg. So you kind of just have this influence upon influence upon influence really snowballing and ending up with this movie that loves the movies that's come before it, loves what it's doing, and also loves films about dinosaurs and has a lot of fun, but takes it, you know, that right balance of seriously, but also knowing there's a bit of silliness to it as well.
I do want to let John Boy know that we have a little bit of Godzilla discussion and clips coming up for him. So stick around for that, John Boy. But first, let's go back a bit. You mentioned Ray Harryhausen earlier and let's talk about his approach to dinosaur films. At the time, how did the tech go down with viewers, and how long ago was this?
So we're looking at, you know, from the late 40s onwards, really. You know, he's a special effects whiz, an animator who himself was inspired by somebody else doing the same job, Willis H. O'Brien, who is a special effects creator who made some of the first dinosaur movies, shorts, and also features, either as a director or doing special effects. In 1925, there's a movie called The Lost World, no relation to the first Jurassic Park sequel, but obviously you can tell where it's gotten its name. Then O'Brien worked on a little film called King Kong, which has some dinosaur scenes in it. And then Harryhausen is not just a fan of his, but then gets to work with him on the ape-related Mighty Joe Young, but then also the dinosaur sequence in a movie in 1956 called The Animal World. And then you get films on his resume like 1 Million Years BC and The Valley of Guangai, and, you know, very much putting his model-based, stop-motion-based approach to dinosaur animation to the fore, which at the time was, you know, it was pioneering. It was the best special effects that you could get, remembering this is a time before CGI, before people even, you know, had conceived of the idea of having computers that they could use in their daily lives. And even though, you know, you look at it now and they feel a product, those effects feel a product of their time, you still have to appreciate how groundbreaking they were for that time and how effective they are as well.
Obviously, the tech has moved on so much from the, that original stop motion. But I will say, stop motion still has a place. Like, I remember loving Wallace and Gromit when that came, and my kids love the subsequent films, they, and the older ones as well. And, you know, anything like Teletubbies and all those kind of shows by that creator, the stop motion still has an appeal, I think. But how does 1 Million Years BC from Ray Harryhausen hold up as a film and a dinosaur film?
Look, it's interesting because it's not a fantastic film, but it's also not terrible. And the animation in it that's used for the special effects does still hold up. It does still look excellent within this, the scope of this film. You know, you do have a movie. It itself is a remake, because so much in the dinosaur realm is either nodding backwards or remaking something that's gone before, or, you know, remaking it without doing so officially. And I think it works. You do have to get past things like, you know, Raquel Welch's fur bikini. There are some moments in it that don't quite land, but there are some parts with the special effects as well that were technically quite difficult to get, you know, to use these models in a way that it seems to you watching that dinosaurs are plucking a man out of water or picking up and flying off with Raquel Welch. Again, in, you know, the early 60s, not a particularly easy thing to do with the effects available at the time, and stands up even if the movie itself, I think, a bit hit and miss.
You mentioned King Kong earlier. So if we're on the topic of special effects, some outdated, let's say, the different variations of King Kong, where did dinosaurs fit into this movie whenever it may have been made, the different versions of King Kong?
We have three big versions of it. And right in the beginning, 1933, we see dinosaurs on Skull Island, including after King Kong captures the actress and Darrow. So you have men fighting a Stegosaurus and a Brontosaurus. Kong himself fights a T-Rex. You have a Pteranodon trying to fly away with Anne, something that 1 Million Years BC nods to when it has a similar kind of scene. Then we get in 1976 a remake with Jeff Bridges, Charles Grodin, and Jessica Lange. No dinosaurs. But then Peter Jackson comes along in 2005 with Jack Black, Adrian Brody, Naomi Watts, brings them back on Skull Island. And I think when they are in the King Kong story, they are important to helping establish what the contrast that's always been at the heart of the King Kong movies between the wild, natural, untamed world, including with prehistoric beasts alongside this colossal ape, and the man-made world of New York, where they're always trying to take Kong, and the impact that humanity can have on nature.
And Can you watch it now and take it seriously?
Look, I think you can, because I think you need to. I think, one, the story still holds up, so much so that we have had it repeated, you know, at several different times. But two, you need to think about the effects and the film in its historical context. You know, the effects that were used on King Kong by O'Brien were the finest of their time. It wasn't like there were more advanced techniques available and he chose not to. And so I think you need to watch these movies with that in mind. I don't think modern audiences always do. I've been to some pretty you know, packed screenings of films like King Kong, films like The Birds by Alfred Hitchcock, with audiences laughing at the special effects. And I think, you know, maybe that's just a discomfort with the fact that, you know, that's what was available to filmmakers at the time. But I think it's better to reflect on how far special effects have come since, particularly since the computer-generated imagery has become an industry standard, and also still appreciating how effective these movies are with their effects at the time. You know, the original King Kong is effective. You know, it has stood the test of time for a reason, working with what was available to the special effects crew at the time.
You're listening to Nightlife. We're speaking with Sarah Ward, going into the world of dinosaur movies and, I guess, dinosaur-adjacent creature movies. Sarah, I'm reflecting on something right now as you're speaking. The fact that we're talking about King Kong and Godzilla, when we're also talking about dinosaur movies, it sort of says that technically dinosaurs are monsters for monster movies. It's not so much a dinosaur movie as a monster movie. I just had that thought. Is it correct?
I think so. In the same way that Jaws for Steven Spielberg, that's a monster movie. It just happens to be a big shark and something much more relatable than something fantastical. It's interesting, on Jurassic Park, Steven Spielberg was so committed to realism, and that's the reason why the effects look just phenomenal. But he made certain that you weren't allowed to refer to the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park among the crew and cast. They weren't creatures. They weren't monsters. They were animals. But generally, and he still does use them in that, you know, menacing way there, but they generally are the big bad in a type of monster movie, which is interesting because they're just being who they are. Dinosaurs can't help it, especially dinosaurs that have been genetically reanimated in modern times around humans that they've never interacted with, because despite what something like 100 million years BC says, humans and dinosaurs didn't exist at the same time. So dinosaurs are just doing their thing and humans are in the way. We probably shouldn't use them as monsters the way that we do in films, but you're right, they are used as monsters in movies.
That's fascinating. I never knew that about Spielberg's "don't call them monsters" rule. That's interesting. Some kind words for you, Sarah, on the text line from Sean. He says, "I've just turned the radio on, and Sarah Ward is doing movie reviews. I love her storytelling." So there you go, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
So your storytelling is good. The subsequent Jurassic Park storytelling, maybe not so much. So let's talk about Godzilla. Why do you consider this part of the dinosaur film genre?
Look, I think, one, yes, Godzilla is a fictional creature, but so clearly inspired by dinosaurs and prehistoric reptiles, design-wise, that they were a specific inspiration. And if you take those really real animals and then filter them through in the 1950s in Japan, fears of what the nuclear age with the bombings in World War II was awakening in people, and this is what you get. And so you get Godzilla, even at his most rampaging and violent, you know, being this villain, but again, doing what he does like dinosaurs do. You know, Godzilla didn't ask to be created or awakened, you know, just like the world didn't ask for, you know, nuclear power to wreak such havoc during war. And so you have this franchise of films, particularly the Japanese films, which, you know, there's over 30 of them, the 34th film in the Japanese films that is going to come out in November this year, Godzilla Minus Zero. You have these movies that are, you know, working on all of these levels, and I think it's impossible not to see them as dinosaur movies. Again, fantastical dinosaurs, yes, but even just looking at him, he's a dinosaur.
Yes, he is. I do really remember enjoying the 1998 Godzilla movie with Matthew Broderick in the lead. That was fun. I mean, I was, 13, 14, so it was probably that's why. But I thought that was pretty good. What do you think?
Look, I don't think that one holds up very well.
Oh, well.
But this is a huge franchise. You have, as I said, all of those Japanese films. And before the one that comes out this year, the one before that won an Oscar. First time that a Godzilla movie has won an Oscar for, of course, special effects. Then more recently, you've got that 98 American film, but we've also had 5 American films in what they're calling the Monsterverse. A 6th one comes out next year, Godzilla X Kong Supernova, which was shot in Australia. And so this is then, I mean, there was the 3rd ever Japanese Godzilla movie was a King Kong versus Godzilla movie. But you are then getting this kind of meeting of worlds, this meeting of Kong Skull Island with its dinosaurs right back in 1933, and this giant Japanese beast that's a response to what Japan went through in World War II, bringing them together now in American movies that have had their ups and downs but are generally good, and also have a really great TV offshoot as well with another one, a spin-off from that to come. So it is huge and there's so much to it. And I think the more recent ones definitely make the Matthew Broderick movie look not too good at all.
Mind you, I haven't watched it in many, many years. I have to give it another spin. Sarah John wants to know if lagoon monsters count.
Look, I think it depends on how they look. And, you know, there are kind of variations of lagoon monsters, and there you're probably going more, you know, things are getting influenced by stuff like the Loch Ness Monster instead. So probably not, but there are aquatic dinosaurs. So I think it probably just depends, again, what they look like and how dinosaur-like you feel they are.
Just going back to what you were saying about post-war anxieties appearing in the Japanese versions of Godzilla. Do you know much about animes, like prominent animes that have in recent years?
Well, I know a decent amount.
The Attack on Titan is very similar. It's giants. So this mythical city is being attacked by horrific giants. You know how some of these animes are, well, they're animated, but that's violent, the most violent thing you've ever seen. But that sort of reminds me of Godzilla. It's this big, large threat that you can't communicate with, and that's sort of, I don't think it's a dinosaur. I mean, I don't think it's a, well, I guess it's a monster series, an animated series. And we can't forget animations when it comes to dinosaur films, because one of the most famous dinosaur films was, of course, The Land Before Time. Let's hear a little bit of that one.
Dear sweet little foot, do you remember the way to the Great Valley?
I guess so. But why do I have to know? You're gonna be with me.
I'll be with you. Even if you can't see me.
What do you mean, if I can't see you? I can always see you.
Littlefoot, let your heart guide you. It whispers. So listen closely.
So that's Littlefoot finding his gravely injured mother, and that's her final words to him. Sarah, honestly, I don't know if you're my vintage, but that puts a lump in my throat. I know it's a cartoon film for children, but I just feel they did things differently in the 90s and 80s with the stories in the animated films for kids.
Well, I completely agree. I saw this as a very small child, and I think if you first saw this as a very small child, especially around when it came out, which I did, you'll never forget it. So one of the fun things, I'm going to mention Steven Spielberg again. He is one of the producers of this, and the whole pitch originally for this movie from him was Bambi with dinosaurs. And you can see that in the way that it works in the story. You know, everybody does have this emotional connection to this movie because it is incredibly sad, and you do feel for the situation that Littlefoot's in. Everybody knows what happens in Bambi with Bambi's mum. So making that comparison here, even if you haven't seen The Land Before Time, you can connect the dots. There's such a sweetness to this movie too, and it looks really beautiful, really gorgeous animation. And it's also doing something that dinosaurs don't do. These dinosaurs are relatable characters. They're not villains. They're not the bad guys. And it is a movie that then taps into that fascination that Michael Crichton recognized that we have from a young age with dinosaurs, but says, hey, these dinosaurs can be characters that we can just spend time with that aren't scaring anybody. So much so that this is a huge franchise. Back in, you know, the 80s and 90s, big Disney hits always had direct-to-DVD sequels. These days, they end up on cinema in cinemas or in streaming. This isn't a Disney movie, but from 1995 to 2016, there have been 13 sequels to The Land Before Time. Probably haven't seen any of them. I've only ever seen the
first. No, I have. Do you know I have? Because my youngest brother loved them.
Oh, and wonderful.
He was so little that he couldn't tell how much lower quality they were than the cinematic release of the first Land Before Time. And another brother used to give him a bit of a hard time about it.
Oh, look, in my house, the films that were always on repeat in the early 90s were the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle films. So,
oh, yes.
Like, every family has their, like, one or two movies where, especially in the VHS age, those tapes just got worn out. And this franchise, though, so hugely popular. And I think if it hadn't been as popular, we wouldn't have had quite a number, or we wouldn't have had dinosaur elements in a number of things that came afterwards. You think about the Toy Story films, and they have a dinosaur toy character, Rex. We had the fifth one of those just this year. Ice Age movies, of course, you know, get into the dinosaur realm, and we're getting a new one of those called Boiling Age next year. But then you even have things like the Super Mario movies, although Yoshi only shows up in the sequel, which was out this year. But, you know, you do have all of these things deciding for children they're going to tap into dinosaurs. Next month we're getting a Paw Patrol movie that's Paw Patrol the Dino movie. Oh. So, big business.
Don't get me started on Paw Patrol.
I think, though, if The Land Before Time wasn't the phenomenon it was, maybe we wouldn't have, you know, dinosaurs as elements in so many of these other franchises.
Now, you just mentioned Super Mario Brothers, the live action one, and also the one that just came out. So let's the 2023 film. I want to play you a clip of Princess Daisy meeting Yoshi, who is, of course, in the Mario universe, the dinosaur character. And she's meeting Yoshi under Dennis Hopper's King Koopa watch.
Kiara.
Go ahead and say it. Dinosaur. Yoshi is a pet of the royal family. You may pet him. Just, don't move your hands around like a small wounded animal.
You must be the great Koopa.
That I am. Ruler of all that you see. A few miserable streets and an endless desert.
You've done a lovely job.
Well, thank you.
So, what do we think of that one? Is Yoshi, I mean, is it valid? Is it classified as a dinosaur for a dinosaur film, or is it a video game film, isn't it?
Well, it's a video game film, but it is a dinosaur film because, you know, in the games, Yoshi is a dinosaur, and apparently...
Oh, yeah. Yep. So is Bowser, isn't he? Is he a dinosaur?
Well, the thing with the Koopas is they're more turtle-like, and so that's one of the interesting things that the live-action movie
does. Of course he is.
Does.
They have shells. They have shells. I played so much Mario. Why did I think he was so...
But that's the thing. These movies, right, so this one movie with Dennis Hopper that we heard there, what it does is it decides that when the dinosaurs were wiped out, a few survived and went to an alternate universe and then evolved. And they evolved into human-like creatures. So King Koopa in this, played by Dennis Hopper, even though Koopas are turtles in the games, is evolved from a dinosaur, lives in a city called Dinohattan, and then has Yoshi as a pet. So this is a movie that 1993 was not afraid to get weird with adapting a video game, which wasn't as common as it is these days. And it is a movie that does come out at a time where you had things like Tim Burton's Batman movies and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movies as well, where, you know, leaning a bit more into fantasy in these kind of things, you know, was perhaps more par for the course. And a movie that this movie came out 2 weeks before the original Jurassic Park, completely dwarfed by it.
Oh, sorry, I gave the wrong year. It wasn't 2023. Someone's written that for me, and I'm just reading it, but I know, yeah, I know what you mean. Yes, before the first Jurassic Park in the, what was it,
1993.
Yeah.
And so, but as I said, it is something that kind of decides, all right, it's going to go its own way. I read that the team behind this, you know, the effects team, they obviously knew Jurassic Park was in the works, and so they decided purposely to veer away from realism to have a bit more fun with it. And there are techniques that they use, very technical special effects techniques that were pioneering in their own way. But compare this as a dinosaur movie to Jurassic Park, and you know, Jurassic Park makes you feel as though you are literally watching dinosaurs. You know it's a movie, but they look so fantastic through a combination of animatronics and CGI that was pioneered for it to be as realistic as Steven Spielberg was adamant it had been. And then you get the Super Mario Brothers movie, which is a whole lot more sillier and not trying to be, you know, photorealistic. And so they are kind of two sides of the same coin, but a really interesting way at looking at how do you bring dinosaurs to the screen? Because before you had Jurassic Park level special effects, in that time between Roy Harryhausen models and Jurassic Park, how did you make them stand out, look realistic, not look a bit cartoonish and silly? It was definitely a problem for special effects teams just because the technology wasn't there to make it look like real life.
I'm glad you clarified earlier that Koopas are in fact turtles, the Koopas from the Mario universe. Speaking of turtles, Sean also says that he saw the animation The Red Turtle, and it was a fascinating, simple animated story. I will have to check that out, Sean. I've not heard of that one.
It's partly, so it's a French-Japanese co-production.
Oh.
And on the Japanese side, it is Studio Ghibli. And when we were talking before about Japanese animation and reacting to the war, they have some films that definitely do that, including what I think is their best movie called Grave of the Fireflies, which is just heartbreaking.
To
watch that movie. But built into Japanese cinema is obviously this reckoning with the war, because how could it not be? But, you know, you watch any Japanese animation and you're in for a treat. Absolutely. So I'm up there with The Red Turtle. Not related to dinosaurs.
But this is what happens when you start talking about movies, isn't it? It goes in all sorts of directions. And, you know, I'm not going to describe the one particularly traumatic scene in Grave of the Fireflies. Again, I'll remind everyone that it is animated, but that takes the themes going on in Land Before Time to a whole nother level. Just traumatic, but you know, a fantastic, fantastic Japanese film. Well, from the very, very serious to the very, very silly, Sarah. we're speaking with Sarah Ward, who is a film critic all about dinosaur films. Sarah, tell us about Tammy and the T-Rex.
This is a movie really unlike anything else we've been talking about, and that's saying something given that we have been talking about a really wide-ranging array of dinosaur films. So it's a horror comedy that looks like it was made for about $5 and knows it. It's a B-movie, but even B-movie might be being a bit too kind. And one of the reasons it keeps earning attention after the 90s when it was made is because it stars Denise Richards and Paul Walker, and it involves putting Paul Walker's brain in a dinosaur. Yes, really.
Okay.
So it was the third credit for both of them at the time, very young in their careers. And you've got the future Bond girl and the future Fast and Furious star playing a high school couple who they have her ex, Billy, complicating their love. He's a bit of a thug. He's so enraged about Tammy moving on that he takes Michael, Paul Walker's character, leaves him in a wild animal park where he's attacked by lions, then ends up comatose in a hospital. And then there's a kind of scheming doctor called Dr. Wackenstein, not a nod to Dr. Frankenstein at all, takes his brain and then puts it into a robotic T-Rex. And then this T-Rex, though, it's thinking like the human character. One, wants revenge for the guy that put him in this situation, and two, wants to reunite with his girlfriend, yes, as a dinosaur. So it's ridiculous. It's obviously just flat out ridiculous. And the story behind it is pretty ridiculous as well. So the filmmaker behind this, Stuart Raffel, who beforehand had made Mac and Me, which is pretty much an E.T. ripoff, so Steven Spielberg again. And he was approached by a man who owned some theatres in South America and had an animatronic T-Rex with eyes and arms and a head that moved, and said, hey, why don't we make a movie with this? except they only had 2 weeks, and then this animatronic was being sent to a park in Texas. So this director spent a week writing the script and then shot this movie incredibly quickly, apparently all in locations within 25 minutes of his own house. And it is a ridiculous mess, but it is also a movie that sometimes it's just so bad and stupid that it is very entertaining, even if you're watching it now. And it's really self-aware of that fact. And it does come at a time where other movies were getting, you know, around 1994 that were putting teens in really heightened or fantastical, you know, sci-fi leaning situations with stuff like the Bill and Ted films and Buffy the Vampire Slayer as a movie, the Teen Wolf movies, Weird Science. We just had Encino Man a couple of years before this came out. So it's pretty par for the course, but it's the worst of the bunch. But it's also just ridiculous that everyone needs to watch it once. But just don't say you haven't been warned that it's terrible, but you'll also laugh a whole lot of the way through it.
Well, let's get a sense of just how ridiculous this film is. Tammy and the T-Rex, here's a little bit of the trailer.
This Tyrannosaurus Rex just wants to be a party animal. Even when you tell the truth, nobody believes it anymore.
It was a dinosaur.
What?
It's more than a machine with a brain. I mean, it is a machine with feelings. We are on the brink of something special.
Ah! We are going to be immortalized.
Is that really you in there? Oh, Michael, what have they done to you?
Oh, you poor thing. You've gone crazy.
Byron, I am not going crazy. This is just a little hard to explain.
That's my dinosaur!
Yeah, even the voiceover, it's a vibe, isn't it? You can it sort of imagine it.
It is indeed. And I do appreciate the fact that, you know, in the movie, the dinosaur is a robot as well. They're trying to make it come to life with a human brain. I like the fact that they've gone, all right, we've got this animatronic dinosaur. We're not going to try and pass it off as a real dinosaur. Probably the smartest move they've made with this. There's nothing quite like this film, but it does demonstrate one. As storytellers, filmmakers are so drawn to wanting to bring dinosaur stories to the screen that they will put something this crazy and follow the path as crazy to get this movie to the screen as happened. And now we have, yeah, Tammy and the T-Rex again, nothing like it. It's an outlier in dinosaur movies, but I'm also glad it exists.
You're listening to Nightlife. We're speaking with Sarah Ward, who is a film critic for Screen International, all about dinosaur movies. I am obsessed with Jurassic Park. I have been since I was 9 years old, and I still want to hear about your obsessions. 1-300-222. I forgot the number for a second. That's crazy. You had 1-300-800-222. 1-300-800-222. What are you obsessed with? We have Liz is obsessed with her dogs. Daniel is obsessed with South Park. John Boy's got a fondness for Godzilla. And I would like to give a shout out to Ian because he's got an obsession with it's outlined by Glenn Campbell in a song, I Knew Jesus Before He Was a Star. Okay, Ian, I promise you I'm going to play that for you at some point, hopefully before the end of the hour. But before we do that, I think we need to just double check. Is there any dinosaur film of note that we haven't covered? First of all, I didn't realize there were so many, Sarah, but any worthy mentions before we say goodbye?
I think that there's a film a couple of years ago, back in 2023, called 65. And the whole idea of this movie is really Adam Driver fights dinosaurs. And I think those four words are a pretty good sell. The film itself doesn't turn out as entertainingly as you would hope. And it's a shame because it's got a couple of directors, Scott Beck and Brian Woods, who as writers, they wrote A Quiet Place, which became a huge hit. And this is a movie, though, that it owes a few more debts to too many places. You know, you are thinking of the Jurassic films here, but also Predator and Alien movies, even something like Planet of the Apes. But the idea of Adam Driver fighting dinosaurs, it's not a bad one. And this is a movie that it's not terrible. It just should be better than it is. There's also some pretty good dinosaur TV shows from across.
Yes, there's a text here. There's a text here that says 90s was huge for dinosaurs. I know you're talking movies, but remember the TV series Dinosaurs? Yes, I do. Should we talk about that quickly?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you were alive then and I was to say the words not the mama, you will absolutely get flashbacks to dinosaurs. this series, a Jim Henson idea. You know, he had the idea to make this series showing how broadly he would think about puppetry beyond stuff like The Muppets and Fraggle Rock and his involvement in Sesame Street. And when he first had it, people thought it wouldn't work. Then The Simpsons became a hit. And even though TV comedies about families, including in some pretty weird and wonderful situations, weren't new, you know, we just had Alf as a big hit on TV. But once The Simpsons was a hit, a network was willing to give Dinosaurs a go. And it is, you know, a family sitcom, but the family are dinosaurs back, you know, 60 million plus years ago when Earth is just one continent. And so you're spending time with them as the Sinclair family. This was a huge show and had some decent actors involved in terms of voice work. Future Arrested Development star Jessica Walter voices the mother.
Wow.
And the way that it ended, this is one of those TV shows that people will always talk about the ending of this because we all know what happened to the dinosaurs. And this is a series that doesn't shy away from it. It did have environmental themes throughout it. And in that last episode, it gets bleak and grim, even though it's a family-friendly sitcom that was very entertaining, very lively all the way throughout. This is such a bold project from kind of go to woe that you can't talk about dinosaurs without talking about this. And, you know, the type of show that most of it you probably really loved. If you were too young and you watched that final episode, it might have even given you a few nightmares.
Yeah, it's gone down in TV history as quite of the most depressing sitcom endings of all time, actually. Now, Richard has just scraped in there with a good suggestion. Walking with Dinosaurs 3D in 2013 used real 3D glasses. Oh, that's a good one. That's a faux nature documentary, computer-generated nature doco, I think. Is that right?
And it started on TV and then we had the film and I believe they also did kind of live touring versions. But if you want to watch a nature documentary about dinosaurs a couple of years back, Prehistoric Planet, which had the brilliant idea of what's the one thing that everybody wants in a documentary about dinosaurs? David Attenborough. So you have this brilliant photorealistic dinosaur footage that looks like it would be in any other David Attenborough documentary, except, of course, it's all of the creatures are CGI because there weren't cameras all of those years ago. And then you have David Attenborough narrating as he would any other nature documentary. It's such a wonderful pairing and it really works. And this is a series that I think has really raised the bar even beyond the Jurassic Park and World films as to how dinosaurs can look on screen. I think even the last couple of Jurassic World movies kind of suffered in comparison, but David Attenborough and dinosaurs, match made in heaven. This is a really wonderful series.
You know what, Sarah, they told me there was not an hour's worth of chat in dinosaur films. I am so, so happy you proved that wrong. Thank you so, so much for joining us. It's been really wonderful speaking with you.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Sarah Ward there. She is a film critic for Screen International. We've been talking dinosaur films and things you're obsessed with, because that's something I'm obsessed with.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.